aggressive relationship against a third party. So because of this, I don't think that the countries in the region, they don't want to join any side. And because the Chinese aren't pushing them to join an alliance against Americans, all they have to do is sit this one out. Sure. And again, if you want to ally against China, that would be a huge risk for the countries in Asia. And as you see, besides from Japan and South Korea, you don't even find any countries in the region who wants to join the sanctions against Russia. So if they're not willing to join against Russia, then certainly it's going to be a hard sell to, you know, try to set them up as proxies against the Chinese.
Thank you. We're going to end it there. Ray McGovern, we appreciate it. Former CIA analyst there from Raleigh, North Carolina. Glenn Deason, a pleasure. Professor of Political Science at the University of Southeastern Norway from Oslo. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 97 to 99 of chapter Nisan from the Holy Quran, recited by Hashim Rouhani.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Innal ladhina توفاهم الملائكة ظالمي أنفسهم قالوا فيما كنتم قالوا كنا مستضعفين تضعفين في الأرض قالوا ألم تكن أرض الله واسعة فتهاجروا فيها فأولئك مأواهم جهنم وساءت مصيرا إلا المستضعفين من الرجال والنساء وكان الله عفوا غفورا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely as for those whom angels cause to die while they are unjust to their souls, they shall say, "In what state were you?" They shall say, "We were weak in the earth." They shall say, "Was not Allah's earth spacious, so that you should have migrated therein?" So these it is whose abode is hell, and it is an evil resort. Except the weak from among the men and the children, who have not in their power the means, nor can they find a way to escape. So these, it may be, Allah will pardon them, and Allah is pardoning, forgiving. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran summons the German ambassador over Berlin's interventionist comments on the country's response to the riots. The US is lobbying to stop the United Nations from blacklisting companies doing business in Israeli settlements. Also in the headlines, the European Union will be adding $2 billion to a fund feeding arms into Ukraine. Top story: Iran's foreign ministry has summoned the German ambassador to Tehran over what the ministry calls Berlin's meddlesome statements on the ongoing riots in Iran. The ministry expressed its strong protest over Germany's unacceptable intervention in Iran's internal affairs. It also denounced Germany for supporting the riots in Iran. The ministry expressed regret that Berlin has adopted an ambivalent approach to subversive efforts. That's in reference to a Wednesday coup attempt in Germany where police have arrested over 24 people. The German government has condemned Iran's execution of a rioter. It also questioned the Islamic Republic's lawful response to the riots, which erupted following the death of young woman Mahsa Amini in mid-September. Meanwhile, Iran is pledging to respond to the Western sanctions and intervention in its affairs over the recent riots in the country. The Iranian foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, made the pledge in a phone call with EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell. Western countries have been condemning Iran's response to the unrest. They have imposed sanctions on the country for alleged crackdown on protesters. Amir Abdullahian also touched on the talks to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. The foreign minister said the US, France, Germany, and the UK are wrong to assume that they can pressure Iran into making concessions in the negotiations. However, he stressed that the discussions are on track to take the final step toward a good, strong, and durable agreement. Author and journalist Robert Fantina tells us more about Western double standards on human rights.
Germany is criticizing Iran's policies, and yet it says nothing about Israel's brutal, ongoing, for decades, policies against the Palestinians. The killings of the Palestinians, the destruction of their homes, the destruction of their economy. Germany has full diplomatic relations with Israel and never says a word about that. And now when there's some internal unrest in Iran, it is immediately condemning the Iranian government. The same with Canada. Canada needs to get its act cleaned up regarding its treatment of indigenous people within our borders. I'm in Canada. Before it starts criticizing anybody else for any alleged or genuine human rights violations. Canada is committing them on a regular basis against Indigenous people in Canada, and so is in no position to denounce any other country's behaviors until it does it about its own. This hypocrisy we see in certainly the United States, where people of color are imprisoned at a much higher rate, astronomically higher rate than whites, where racism is institutionalized, and yet the United States will criticize what's happening in Iran and what the Iranian government is doing. It's all to bring about regime change so that a government that's compliant to U.S. demands, that will follow U.S. dictates, will be installed in Iran.
Palestinians hold a funeral procession for a teenager killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. 16-year-old Diyar Rahimi was killed in a village northwest of Ramallah on Thursday. Three Palestinians were also killed and several others injured on the same day during an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp. Friday was declared a day of public mourning. In Jenin, Israeli forces have been escalating deadly attacks against Palestinians, killing over 160 this year alone across the West Bank. The resistance movement Hamas has reacted defiantly to the surge in Israeli violence. It says the regime will only make Palestinians more resolute in their resistance.
Israeli forces have shot dead three Palestinians during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in northern West Bank. According to eyewitness accounts, a large number of Israeli military forces stormed the camp on Thursday morning. The attack triggered violent confrontations with local residents, during which Palestinians were killed. The victims were identified by Palestinian media as Tariq al-Damj, Siddiqui Zakarneh, and Atta Shibli. According to reports, before the confrontation broke out, Israeli snipers were positioned on the rooftops of buildings overlooking the camp. At least 10 people have also been injured there. Israeli forces also fired directly at an ambulance during the raid, and its medical staff reportedly survived death. Israeli forces have recently been conducting overnight raids and killings in the northern occupied West Bank, mainly in the cities of Jenin and Nablus. New groups of Palestinian resistance fighters have been formed there. The latest figures bring up the number of Palestinians killed by the Israeli forces since the beginning of the year to 216. At least 164 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank. Scores of Palestinians have also been killed in Israeli raids in the Gaza Strip.
Simply saying this, Israeli establishment, the military, the security apparatus, and the settlers have clear orders to kill. They kill Palestinians even in cases of suspicions. They are always quick to pull the trigger. Recently, almost all raids to the West Bank areas leave Palestinians either killed or injured, and none of the soldiers have been investigated to any of the crimes.
According to the United Nations, the number of Palestinians killed by Israel in the occupied West Bank this year is the highest in 16 years. Rights organizations say that Israel is conducting a shoot-to-kill policy against Palestinians.
Their main program is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And the second is to suppress any form of resistance of Palestinian people and to enhance settlements everywhere. So practically, Israel has all the interest in enhancing the oppression against Palestinians. And we've seen even certain escalation during election time because Israeli parties were using Palestinian blood to feed their election purposes.
Meanwhile, the Qatari state-funded network says it has filed a complaint against Israel at the International criminal court over the killing of its veteran journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. The network says it has new evidence that the regime's forces directly fired at her. Abu Akleh was shot in the head on May 11 while covering an Israeli raid in the Jenin refugee camp.
The rising violence against Palestinians comes against the backdrop of Israel's defiance to be held accountable for its crimes. The Qatar state-funded broadcaster Al Jazeera has filed a lawsuit at the International Criminal Court, the ICC, over the killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Al Jazeera says it has new evidence showing that she was killed by Israeli forces.
Many have called for an investigation. Shireen's family who are here today have made their own request. The Palestinian Authority has provided a comprehensive body of evidence, and yet there's been complete silence from the Office of the Prosecutor on this case, on cases across the board, in fact, in the Palestine situation.
The veteran journalist was shot in the head, killed on May 11, while she was covering their raid in the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. At the time of her killing, the 51-year-old journalist was wearing easily recognizable press attire. Al Jazeera now says its legal team has conducted a full and detailed investigation into the case and has unearthed new evidence based on several eyewitness accounts and video footage that clearly shows that Abu Akleh and her colleagues were directly fired in a deliberate killing by Israeli forces.
While there is overwhelming evidence from multiple eyewitnesses, over a dozen of investigations by reputable news outlets and human rights organizations and the United Nations, that Shireen was targeted and killed by an Israeli soldier, my family still doesn't know who the person is that shot that deadly bullet and who was involved in the chain of command that allowed them to kill my aunt.
It says the claim by Israeli authorities that the Palestinian journalist was killed by mistake in an exchange of fire is, quote, completely unfounded. Multiple investigations by independent organizations and media outlets have already concluded that Abu Akleh was deliberately shot by Israeli forces.
This was a proposal that was floated with only in recent hours, only today, by Al Jazeera. So I don't know that it has been a topic of discussion. I don't know that it would be a topic of discussion unless we had representations from the ICC that they were going to take an opinion one way or another.
Well, I mean, she was an American citizen.
Of course.
So you have, there is, you know, it's not like you have no interest in it
at all.
But you oppose it.
We oppose it in this case for the reasons that
The Israeli military, following a long denial, finally admitted in September that Abu Akleh might have accidentally been killed by Israeli fire directed towards suspects identified as armed Palestinian gunmen. The United States has said it's investigating the case, but has refused to publicly condemn Israel for the killing.
And the U.S. says it's pressing the United Nations not to update a blacklist of companies doing business in Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. The U.S. State Department says the country opposes any work to update the list. It claims the database reinforces bias against Israel and poses a genuine threat to companies active in those settlements, which are illegal under international law. The list was first published in 2020 by the UN Human Rights Office. It came in response to a 2016 resolution by the UN Human Rights Council that called for identification of businesses engaged in activities related to the settlements. The listing has helped human rights groups to pressure those companies to boycott Israel over its crimes against Palestinians. Elsewhere, Chinese President Xi Jinping says his country would work to buy oil and gas in its national currency, the yuan, a move that supports Beijing's goal to establish its currency internationally. Xi says Beijing will also make full use of the Shanghai Petroleum and National Gas Exchange as a platform for oil and gas trade with yuan. He made the remarks in Saudi Arabia, where he is attending a number of regional summits. China is the third largest trading entity in the world, behind only the United States and the European Union. Beijing has been encouraging partners to use the yuan in bilateral trade in a de-dollarization push. Political commentator Digby James Wren says China's attempt to de-dollarize its oil and gas purchases is another sign of shifting from the greenback to currencies other than the US dollar.
This is a very consequential shift in global markets. It makes sense, and as you mentioned in your introduction, the Shanghai Commodities Exchange is a key part of that, and that's taken quite a few years to set up. You cannot have this kind of exchange in yuan directly for energy if you don't have commodity markets established. So that was the first or one of the steps that needed to be taken. But it also shows that for the Saudis and for the BRICS nations, for example, and also for the members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, that there's a definite shift in the global south. The Americans have really undermined their own reputation because they've been weaponizing the use of the dollar. And so, of course, that accelerated the need or the requirement of other countries to not to stop using the dollar, but to start using the yuan and the euro much more. So a kind of a tripartite, sort of a three currencies, which I like to call the yes arrangement. So yuan, euro, and dollar. So this is a stabilization of the global financial and commodities markets.
The Russian president says Moscow is considering whether to adopt the U.S. concept of preemptive military strikes. Vladimir Putin says Russia could amend its military doctrine by introducing the possibility of such strikes to disarm an enemy. The Russian president was speaking to reporters during a summit in Kyrgyzstan. He said Russia's cruise missiles and hypersonic systems were more modern and even more efficient than those in the United States. For years, the Kremlin has expressed concern about U.S. efforts to develop the so-called conventional prompt global strike option. The capability involves hitting an adversary's strategic targets with precision-guided conventional weapons anywhere in the world within 1 hour. France is playing down comments made by President Emmanuel Macron about offering Russia security guarantees. That's after the remarks triggered tensions with Ukraine. An aide to the French leader says his comments were taken out of context and that he was repeating a call for a negotiated settlement to the war in Ukraine. Macron has said the West should respect Russia's need for security guarantees in any talks to end the conflict. The secretary of Ukraine's National Security Council, however, sees this as providing guarantees to what he calls a terrorist and murderous state. Moscow initially went to war over security concerns after Ukraine tried to join NATO. Russia said at the time that it would not tolerate NATO at its doorstep. In Peru, supporters of former President Pedro Castillo block roads and burn barricades in different cities to demand the closure of the Congress and early elections. A flashpoint is the city of Arequipa, where hundreds of farmers blocked a coastal highway. The protesters say they do not recognize Dina Boluarte as interim president. Boluarte took office hours after the removal of her predecessor. She has called for calm as protests broke out in support of Castillo. He tried to dissolve the Congress just hours before his impeachment, and he was detained and is now facing criminal charges. That brings an end to the World Bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's blockade on Gaza through land, sea, and air has badly affected the tiny enclave's residents. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Electronic Intifada wrote, Kamel Arafat's family is in constant fear that something bad could happen to him. Relatives of the firefighter from the Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza City have therefore decided to try to stay in constant touch with him during emergencies. It doesn't quite suit Arafat, 38, even if he appreciates the concern. It is better not to call. I've asked my family to calm down. They just can't. They're right as well. What we go through is brutal, he said. The father of four has been an emergency responder for 15 years. It joined rescue crews during all recent major Israeli regime aggressions against Gaza starting in 2008. He told the Electronic Intifada, "Every time I hear my phone ringing during escalations, I instantly understand it is work with a new emergency and probably more casualties." He answers such calls with mixed feelings. "We throw ourselves into dangerous situations to rescue people from death, but we know we might be dead ourselves at any moment," he said. During Israeli regime offensives, Arafat works from early morning until late night to rescue people and their belongings, especially those buried under rubble. He sometimes does not return to his house for 4 or 5 or more consecutive nights, he says. "Once we get a chance to rest before heading to a new task, we nap anywhere, anywhere, on any piece of cloth, on the sidewalk, in the car." Despite all the challenges, he said, they will continue to work. No matter the danger, every first responder will only work harder when they hear people crying for help from the rubble. During challenging times, Arafat wants to be next to his children, aged between 6 and 12, and wife to reassure them. "I sometimes hug them so hard before leaving home, a goodbye hug as if I might not return," he said. "First responders usually carry traumatic memories around with them," Arafat has his share. The 2014 massacre, which the Zionist regime carried out in the Shajaya neighborhood of Gaza City, proved particularly harrowing. In 2014, we were able to enter Shajaya after the Zionist regime declared a humanitarian truce. The truce was violated immediately by the Israeli forces. The whole scene was awful. Many bodies were strewn on the ground. Some were fully burnt. They were also the bodies of animals. During the same assault, he still vividly remembers the aftermath of the Wahdan family massacre in the northern Gaza town Beit Hanun. The Zionist regime troops had kept the family inside and used their home as a military base. 12 people died there, and Arafat vividly remembers specifically how the women's bodies were burnt. "I cannot forget at all. It was horrifying," he told the Electronic Intifada, adding, "We saw women besides their children, all dead under the rubble. I sometimes think of their last moments, what they were thinking of and how they felt. It is a bad ending." Like Arafat, Muhammad Abu Shokhfa worked throughout all the Zionist regime's wars on the Gaza Strip. He remembers them all simply as bloody conflicts filled with people in need of his help, except for 2014 when it got more personal and he lost two of his closest colleagues in front of his eyes. Abu Shokhfa, 34, and 5 of his colleagues had been called to Shajaya neighborhood and thought at first that the shelling had stopped. "All of a sudden, a series of heavy explosive tank shells were fired directly at us. Our colleagues Rami Thahar and Ahad Doha were killed in front of my eyes," said Abu Shokhfa. He took a small pause to collect himself before he continued. "It was a shock. I was in disbelief," Abu Shokhfa told the Electronic Intifada. "It was a huge loss for me." For Abu Shokhfa, the job is just that, a job. "I have no difficulty rescuing people I don't know. But it was different with his colleagues. It was much harder," he said. "We were 6 on that mission, only 4 came back. He had done his best to deal with the situation and continue working. But he concedes that I did not give myself enough time to process what he had just seen. There were other people to rescue," he said. "Under pressure, I returned to reality and I started to work again." With limited staff and equipment, Gaza Civil Defense sometimes calls on volunteers to assist in a rescue operation, like in the Wehda Street massacre in Gaza City last year, where residential buildings belonging to Abu al-Awf and al-Qawaliq families were bombed at nearly the same time. Abu Shokhfa said, "Calling more people to join us was important as the destruction was massive.
and we needed to avoid a high rate of civilian casualties. It is the ever-present danger of Israeli regime aggression and the high price such aggression exacts that makes the work of first responders in Gaza so demanding and dangerous. Add to this, an Israeli-imposed siege on Gaza prevents necessary equipment from helping the civil defense forces modernize. Thus, Gaza's firefighters are unable to secure vital items like fire hoses, firefighter lights, or spears under the Zionist regime's so-called dual-use list of banned products. The poor resources available to Gaza's firefighters were briefly noted by Western media last month. The New York Times reported the first two fire trucks which reached the scene of a major fire in Jabalia refugee camp did not even have a ladder between them. That was despite how the building where the fire occurred had a number of floors. A total of 21 people were killed in the Jabalia fire. Better equipment could allow first responders in Gaza to save thousands of lives, Samir Al-Khatib, deputy director of Gaza Civil Defense, said, adding, "We have not been able to keep pace with developments abroad." In all, according to Al-Khatib, Gaza has between 450 and 500 emergency responders, including firefighters. First responders are supposed to be protected under the Geneva Conventions. However, according to Al-Khatib, 34 have been killed during the Zionist regime's aggressions against Gaza since 2008. "We have been targeted multiple times, even though we have always wear our uniforms. Our cars are known to the Israeli side," said Khatib. "But we cannot trust the Israeli troops. We fear the treachery of the occupation forces."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
My name is Clayton Thomas Mueller. I'm a Cree man from Pugetawagon First Nation, which is part of the Cree Nation in northern Manitoba. I think all Native people are born activists when they're born here in Canada or in the United States or any colonial country where Indigenous peoples live under occupation. You know, you're born into activism, and whether or not you take action, you know, kind of is the choice of your life path, I guess. I think about the the future a lot and about, you know, how when I was a child, I had access to so much abundance and beauty, you know, in terms of participating in our culture and participating in harvesting and hunting, you know, from the fruits of our sacred Mother Earth. And I want my sons to be able to have that. And the way things are looking right now with mega development and with climate change and with capitalism, their chances are becoming slimmer and slimmer to have the same relationship that I did with the sacred circle of life. And so for me, being an indigenous activist here in Canada, it's something that I have no choice but to do. And so I've dedicated my life to it.
No more pipeline! 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 No more tankers! No more tankers!
We can't drink oil! We can't drink oil!
The Yinka Dene Alliance, with the inspiration of the 1980s Constitutional Train Action, which was an action at the time where First Nations rented a train and drove it across the country and stopped in each community to educate people about Aboriginal rights. You know, the Yinka Dene Alliance took the inspiration from that lesson, and they rented a train, and they called it the Freedom Train. And they rode that train from Smithers, British Columbia, all the way to Toronto to stand up against the mega corporation Enbridge, which is a oil transport company. They build pipelines. Enbridge is proposing to build a, you know, 900,000 barrel per day pipeline right through the heart of British Columbia's Great Bear Rainforest. This pipeline, if it was built, would cross over 1,200 salmon-producing rivers and streams, all critical spiritual, cultural, and food sources to local indigenous peoples, you know, dozens and dozens of tribes that have been there forever. Threatened by, you know, a potential oil rupture by one of these pipelines into one of those salmon rivers. So many people have rose up in a movement against Enbridge, against the Harper Conservative government, against, you know, the provincial government of Alberta and British Columbia to educate Canadians about the insanity of this pipeline and the insanity of our government for wanting to build it. When they arrived in Toronto, thousands of people met to greet them and joined them in their march through the streets of Toronto's financial district, all the way to the steps of the hotel where Enbridge was having their annual shareholder meeting. And we sent a very powerful message to Enbridge that this pipeline will not be built, and that the corporate board and the CEO are taking unfathomable risks with shareholders' money by investing in a project that'll face decades of legal opposition.
I'm the Vice Chief of Carrier Sakani Tribal Council, North Central British Columbia. We call ourselves the Yinka Dene, which is, means in our language, people of the earth. And basically, we looked at this Enbridge Northern Gateway project. When we looked at all the benefits and the risks, we didn't want this project. So what this demonstration is about is telling the investors into Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline and those investors and inform them that we don't support the project.
When we look at the land, we see it as a living force, a living, sustainable way things are in the woods. That you have your trees, you have your rock nation, you have your wind, you have your fire, you have all of that foliage that's there, all that beauty that's there. And they don't see how we see things. If you take something, you take something out, you're taking the essence of that out of there. You're not putting that essence back, you're not leaving that essence there. You're not covering it back in its natural form. You're just extracting for wealth. You're forgetting that everything that's there in the woods needs that. We all need that. They don't seem to care about the water. They're very tunnel vision. They're like this. That's how I see it.
They keep continuing trying to get this project approved, even though they don't have our permission to be in our territory. And we've tried everything we could to to work with them, to talk to them and explain our position. And they've to this date have not been honest. They've not returned the honor, you know, that we have them of actually we are hosting or looking at their proposal, and then they've not answered any of the questions we've asked. And based on the information we received and on our law, our law that we've governed with for thousands of years, we've made a decision not to allow Enbridge within our territory at all.
The spirit of the industry has no spirit, because everything has a spirit. Everything has an agency. Even an agency, we believe that it has a spirit that governs it, because it's the people of it that look after that. And they don't have, the industry doesn't have that. Because if you look at it, if you look at what it does, like what's its mechanism, it's to assimilate, it's to control, it's to take it away. It's the mindset of just taking. It's a mindset of taking. It doesn't seem to have that concept of tomorrow, my children are going to need this.
We've always made decisions on our land that we base them on our grandkids and great-grandkids down the road. We base all of our decisions on the land to make sure that anything that comes in is we can deal with, and the land can deal with it. Looking at this project, it goes against our traditional governance by not respecting the fact that we said no. It has a potential to devastate all of our ways of life and gathering food that we have. The very thing that gives us life, water, is most precious, and it's going to cross. It would cross into three major water sheds, two in British Columbia, and then of course the Athabasca or the Arctic thing through Alberta and through the Rockies.
And coastal First Nations have, you know, shared a sacred relationship with that ocean, and Canadians in general share a sacred relationship with our Pacific Northern coastline.
I'm Dave. I'm here because I'm a concerned citizen about the environment and basically the recent environmental regulations, how they've been essentially streamlined to benefit corporations. It's kind of important to get our voices heard and let them know that we're not, them being Enbridge and other oil companies, that we're not particularly fans of that.
And our story isn't unique. There are many stories out there in Central America, South America, where a lot of the indigenous people are being subverted, not only by multinational companies, but by their own government. Really, there's a lot of human rights violations that are occurring, much worse than Canada. This is a human rights violation in our definition.
After banking and the financial sector, mining is Canada's largest export in terms of its international presence of Canadian multinational corporations, and Canadian mining projects are systematically engaged in ecological disasters wherever they go, whether it's Central America, South America, the Caribbean, Africa, or the Asia Pacific. Canadian mining companies leave a trail of ecological destruction.
They are using the name of Canada. This is a really well-known country as a democratic country, peaceful country, peacemaker country, and when people know about Canada and they hear about Canadians, they open arms in the beginning. But when they know that it's coming a mining open pit, or it's coming a huge extractive industry that's doing a huge damage to the environment, people start getting like totally opposite thinking about Canadians, right? Because Canadian companies are using this name a lot.
And whether it's displacing indigenous peoples or poor peasants from their land and then poisoning their water systems, mining is a very environmentally destructive process, particularly when it's not being properly regulated, which it's not, either by the Canadian government or by most third world governments.
They use the technology that we know as open pit. It's not just destroy the environment, right? To get the minerals from the earth, what they have to do is destroy the surface. To access to under surface, they have to destroy everything that is in the surface. And in the surface is the people, the village, the town, the river, the trees, the forest, everything that is on the surface, it has to be destroyed.
And so as a result, you have commonly, you see mining companies dump their waste, which includes high levels of arsenic or cyanide and so on and other chemicals, into local water systems, or they create what they call a tailings pond for their waste, which is supposed to be properly lined, but they don't do it properly, and then the water, the toxic water leaks into the soil, into the water, the waterbed in a local community, and it destroys plant life. It poisons people, and it's well documented from Guatemala to Honduras to the Dominican Republic to Tanzania and beyond. It's well documented the toxic impact of Canadian mining companies, and the Canadian government does nothing. It does zero about this.
I think that we have to be very mindful of the fact that Canada continues to generate all its wealth, all its assets, everything, on the backs of indigenous peoples, and that the entire economic paradigm of this country is based on keeping indigenous peoples subjugated and keeping us from having self-determination and control over our land and resources.
Canada doesn't live up to their human rights, what is they're obligated to do by the under what is known as the United Nations, under the United Nations Indigenous Peoples Conference. Well, really, there's a covenant within the United Nations where it says free, prior, and informed consent, yet Canada does not live up to it. And that's, really what they're doing is subverting a lot of international laws as well as their own proclamations where they stated that they have a fiduciary duty to protect indigenous people.
Canada, like America, like Europe, like Australia, like Israel, is a huge advocate of human rights when it advances their neoliberal free market agenda. Last year, Canada went through their periodical UN Human Rights Review, and they scored eighth on the planet in the UN Human Rights Index. But when the committee analyzed Canada's human rights record through its Aboriginal policy and its treatment of Indigenous peoples, Canada scored 48th.
Obviously, Canada has a very deep-rooted relationship to colonialism within Canadian borders. The whole existence of Canada is premised on the dispossession of First Nations peoples and the colonial administration of their communities by the Canadian government via Indian Affairs. But also, even outside Canadian borders, there's a long history of Canadian colonial or imperial practices. For example, the banking industry has a long history in the Caribbean and Latin America. There are mining companies that have relationships to various Central American dictatorships or the dictatorship in Indonesia in the Cold War period. And so there's a long history of colonialism, both within and beyond Canada.
It's more than colonialism. It's, killing the spirit of a nationhood, the belief of a nationhood. It's not colonialism anymore. It's too radical. It's too racial, the approach that this federal government is taking, ignoring the First Nation people, who use and occupy the land.
A lot of people don't get educated in school about how Indian reservations were created. A lot of people don't understand that, the South African apartheid system was based on the reservations apartheid system here in Canada. We didn't have these settlements prior to colonization. For example, residential schools where they took our children away from our parents for 100 years and put them into essentially work camps and beat them for speaking their language and cut their hair. And these schools were magnets for, predators, sexual predators of kids. A lot of the nuns and priests and groundskeepers and whatnot were straight up pedophiles. A lot of our kids, including my own mom and, a lot of my relatives that went, faced severe abuse, sexual, physical abuse when they went to residential school. And I think that what a lot of people don't understand is that Canada is an apartheid country, you know. It still is in very many ways.
Historically, when capitalism emerges in Canada, the focus of the Canadian state vis-a-vis Indigenous peoples was to destroy their Indigenous cultures, their economies, their polities, and so on, and forcefully remove them from the land. And the goal was to gain access to the land and its subsurface minerals and resources. And I would argue that that has been definitive of Canada's relationship with Indigenous peoples ever since to the present day.
The language that is utilized by the Canadian government in dealing with First Nations and talking about their relationship with First Nations globally is the same colonial racist language used by the Zionist government of Israel when talking about Palestinians. It's grounded in the same Eurocentric kind of white patriarchal, you know, kind of power base, that subjugates and looks at, you know, either Palestinian or Indigenous peoples as children, you know, that need to be taken care of as a problem.
The value of our culture, of the land, of the rivers and the lakes, of the practices, of the traditions, is worth so much more than the blood money dollar bills that they keep waving in our faces. Our culture, our lands, our rivers and our waters is more than priceless. It is sacred, and we aren't going to sell it down the river for a couple of, for a pipeline that will is guaranteed to destroy our lives.
About a future where the land is intoxicated and it's polluted and uninhabitable, and it's sad because, and it's scary because that future is possible if we keep continuing on this industrial road that we're on. It's about a future where the Harper government and industry has turned our lands in BC into a giant Walmart.
Well, we're just wrapping up here. The Yinkadeni Alliance leadership has just come out of the annual general shareholder meeting of Enbridge. They're very clear and concise that there's absolutely no way that this pipeline nor the supertanker traffic that it promises to bring to the West Coast will ever happen. And yeah, we're tired, a little bit wet, but feeling very positive.
Environmental laws we use, their laws, and they change it. They change it while we're still fighting. Harper doesn't care. Harper doesn't care about us. He's going to take us to court. We're going to stand in court. I don't care how long we're going to be in court. We're going to be there. My heart's hurting right now. Because governments are not going to listen, never ever going to listen. Only reason why they're doing this, they're trying to take more of our land. We are part of this country too. They can't go on and reap the land without suffering us on a reserve. Everybody thinks Indians get it good. We don't. We come back to our homelands and look at how we live. Live like third world country. Inadequate water, inadequate homes. And they say they give us everything. We have to abide by three or four laws before we can be able to stand up and do anything. But today, we're abiding by our own hereditary law, our traditional law, the Batlats of our area. That's what we're going to stand on, and that's how we're going to win. Tenachaya! Saketne!
No pipeline! No tankers! No pipeline! No tankers!
The earth is coming to its place of fulfillment, I guess, in terms of all of the population, the damage to the water, all of that put together. I think we're coming into a time, I don't know when this is going to happen, but I think we're coming into a time where the earth has to heal itself and it has to renew itself.
Our own Cree nation has a prophecy, the prophecy of the seventh generation, that speaks of a time when a generation of young people would come up and they would be free from the colonial mind, you know, where they would still understand, you know, the violence of colonization, but they would not be crippled by it, and they would, you know, take action. Our prophecy talks about that, and I believe that that's right now, right where we are.
I've heard the prophecy where the people have to unite, have to become one to make that change, to change that renewal process.
And while many get depressed or overwhelmed and even apathetic about, you know, things like climate change and, you know, the austerity agenda of these neoconservative maniacs that are running our country, I see a tremendous amount of hope and light emerging in a social movement that is rising up. You know, to combat against the drivers of climate change, to combat against this economic paradigm. And I'm filled with hope.
In the limelight.
Scientists have recently found that key genes that are active in the brains of older people are also active in the brains of people who developed serious COVID-19. In this regard, we have provided an exclusive article written by the staff of scientific publication Nature. Stay tuned for more. Severe COVID-19 is linked to changes in the brain that mirror those seen in old age, according to an analysis of dozens of post-mortem brain samples. The analysis revealed brain changes in gene activity that were more extensive in people who had severe SARS-CoV-2 infections than in uninfected people who had been an intensive care unit, ICU, or had been put on ventilators or to assist their breathing, treatments used in many people with serious COVID-19. The study published on December 5th in Nature Aging joins a bevy of publications cataloguing the effects of COVID-19 on the brain. It opens a plethora of questions that are important, not only for understanding the disease, but to prepare society for what the consequences of the pandemic might be, says neuropathologist Mariana Bugiani at Amsterdam University Medical Centers, adding, "And these consequences might not be clear for years." Maria Mavrikaki, a neurobiologist at Boston, Massachusetts, embarked on this study about 2 years ago after seeing a preprint, later published as a paper, that described cognitive decline after COVID-19. She decided to follow up to see whether she could find changes in the brain that might trigger the effects. She and her colleagues study samples taken from frontal cortex, a region of the brain closely tied to cognition, of 21 people who had severe COVID-19 when they died and one person with an asymptomatic SARS-CoV-2 infection at death. The team compared these with samples from 22 people with no known history of SARS-CoV-2 infection. Another control group comprised 9 people who had no known history of infection but had spent time on a ventilator or in an ICU, interventions that can cause serious side effects. The team found that genes associated with inflammation and stress were more active in the brains of people who had had severe COVID-19 than in the brains of people in the control group. Conversely, genes linked to cognition and the formation of connections between brain cells were less active. The scientists also analyzed brain tissue from 20 further uninfected people, 10 who were 38 years old or younger at death, and 10 who were 71 or older. A comparison revealed that people in the older group had brain changes that were similar to those seen in people with severe COVID-19. The work is preliminary and will need to be confirmed using complementary approaches, says Daniel Martins D'Souza, head of the Proteomics at the University of Campinas in Brazil. But it is an informative study, he says, and such research could ultimately